Hello and welcome to A History of Alexander the Great Remastered. Episode 1, Introduction. I am Jamie Redfern and shall be your host for this series. You may know me from my other podcasts, A History of Hannibal and the Punic Wars, and The Arab Spring, A History. You may also know me from my series, A History of Alexander. This was my first full podcast series, and is available to download. I'm very pleased with it, but it was recorded with inferior equipment. Now, over 2 years since I began work on the Alexander series, I feel it's time for a reboot. A re-recording of the original series. In addition to the improved quality, there will also be some new material along the way, particularly in the early episodes. I've spent a lot of time studying the period before Alexander since I originally created the series, and I think I can now give a much better background to the topic. So I'm going to give some people, particularly Philip, a lot more attention. But enough of this. Let's just get into it. So, when looking at the list of all-time great figures in world history, one name that has to come up is Alexander the Great. We all know something about him. We may know he was a king of Macedon. We may know he conquered from Greece all the way to India, but probably not much more than that. In this series, I'm going to follow Alexander from his youth in Macedonia to the edge of the known world and back, finding out what he did, and hopefully why he did it. Find out his aims and whether he completed them. What did he really think of himself? And is he as great as everyone thinks he is? We'll begin today by giving some background to the sources and the historical period. You have my apologies in advance for any pronunciations I get wrong. Alexander was born in Macedonia in 356 BC. For us to understand his life, we need to understand what the world was like at the time of his birth, specifically looking at three cultures: the Greeks, the Persians, and the Macedonians. For hundreds of years, Greece had been split up into many different versions of the dominant political system of the day: the city-state, the polis. There were around 1,400 polis around the Greek world, so naturally there was a great variety among them. There was the famous Athens, a cultural centre in the 5th century, Sparta with its professional army, and the great port town of Corinth, along with many others. During the 7th and 6th centuries, Greece had escaped her dark age and was struggling to deal with the new influx of wealth, which led to great political instability. Tyrants sprung up only to fall in the next generation. Tyranny was generally hated and was something to be avoided or removed at all cost. And the individual city-states came up with different ways of dealing with the same problems. Some were able to keep their traditional system of government, oligarchy, rule by the few, sometimes styled as aristocracy, rule by the best. Sparta, seen as an oddity in the ancient world, had a mixed constitution, featuring a dual kingship, an assembly, and an elders' council. Athens, along with other states, chose yet another course: democracy, rule by the people, a ridiculous notion that obviously never caught on. The Persians came from the region of Persis, the piece of land north of the Persian Gulf, which is today modern southern Iran. They exploded onto the Middle Eastern stage in the 550s, and under Cyrus the Great wrestled control of the region from the Median Empire. Cyrus would take control of much of the Middle East and Central Asia. Cambyses II would conquer Egypt in the 520s, and Darius set his sights on invading Europe. The Kingdom of Macedonia had been around since the 800s, occupying modern-day northern Greece. Most of their war-making was against the nearby tribes of Illyria. It wasn't an important state, so we'll leave it there for now. But don't worry, we'll have much more to say about it later. Before we get really into the history of events, it will be worth examining the Spartan and Persian military systems, as this will have a profound impact on world events. Since roughly 750 BC, the Greeks used a military system known as the phalanx. A phalanx is a block of troops that formed a shield wall with long pikes jutting out of it. The troops would face in the same direction, with their shields protecting the man on their left, holding their pike out, and the lines behind them also holding their pikes out. It was usually about 8 ranks deep, but 16 rank and even 32 rank phalanxes have been seen. The Greeks used a 9-foot, 2.4-metre pike, which I think is called a dory. The goal of the phalanx would be to keep pushing forwards until the enemy broke. A phalanx's biggest weakness was being outflanked. When an enemy surrounded the phalanx and was able to attack from the side or even from behind. While this was a danger to any formation, it was particularly dangerous to a phalanx, as the soldiers were packed so closely together that they were unable to turn to meet the threat. A phalanx would usually use lighter troops to protect the sides and prevent this. This is at least the traditional view. Certainly, the phalanx would become the dense wall of spikes jutting out of it during the Hellenistic period. But at this point, it is argued by some that the phalanx was a loose formation. The Greek shield was large, and when combined with a spear or sword, a fighter could require 6 feet of space to work at peak efficiency. I happen to doubt this view, but it is a much debated topic among modern scholarship. I'd simply like to make you aware of the debate, even though I prefer the traditional version, and that's what we will be going with in this narrative. The Persian army was made up of mostly light infantry, who would use a mixture of spears, swords, axes, bows, and they would have wicker shields. Their cavalry would also be light and throw missiles. An elite 10,000 troops called the Immortals, who used spears, swords, and bows, were the Persian secret weapon. Archers were also used. The Persians had quite a basic strategy. They would have a huge army to spook the enemy into surrendering. If that didn't work, they would weaken them with arrows, and then send in wave after wave of troops until the enemy routed. This worked well in the Middle East against many foes, but it would prove difficult when it came up against the Greek phalanx with its discipline and armour. Naval battles were also important in these wars, but their tactics were quite simple when compared to land battles. Both sides had triremes, a warship powered by 3 banks of oars, which would ram the enemy. Simple as that. Now, on to the first Persian invasion of Greece. The Persian Shah, Cyrus the Great, had been dragged into the conquest of the Ionian Greek cities in Asia Minor due to provocation by Croesus of Lydia, a kingdom in Asia Minor. You know this story. Croesus consulted the oracle at Delphi as to whether he should attack Persia, and he received the reply that if he attacked, a great empire would be destroyed, only for it to be Croesus's own empire that fell. Anyway, as Cyrus conquered Lydia, he also inherited Lydia's hegemony over the Greek city-states there. These city-states would not submit quietly to Persian rule. They would be trouble. Cyrus's normal model of rule was to pick out the leadership of the areas he had conquered and leave them in control. In Judea, for example, he left the priests in power. This would not work with the Ionians. They had a leadership, the aristocracy, but it was heavily divided. The Persians settled then on having a tyrant in each of the cities. The word tyrant creates mental images of a harsh ruler who stole power illegally. There were many tyrants in the 7th and 6th centuries who stole power from the aristocracy, but they did so with the support of the people. It was only later that they became hated, as I've previously mentioned. However, the tyrants installed by the Persians did not have the support of the people. They were stuck in limbo, trying to please the people who hated, I repeat, hated Persian rule, and their Persian overlords who kept them in power and could very easily remove them if there was any talk of rebellion. This quite obviously could not last forever. In 499, the tyrant of Miletus, Aristagoras, set off to conquer Naxos with Persian backing. The Persian king of kings, Darius, had already shown ambition to invade Europe in his unsuccessful Scythian expedition in 513. And Aristagoras achieved Persian support for the venture by saying it could be a stepping stone to Greece. Things did not go to plan for Aristagoras. It was an absolute disaster. Having promised things to the Persians and having failed to deliver, he expected to be removed as tyrant. So he did the thing he felt most likely to secure his future safety and power. He led Ionia into revolt. The revolt was supported by Athens and Eretia, but it was eventually put down by the Persians in 493. The Persian king Darius the Great decided to punish Athens and Eretia by invading Greece. The first move by the Persians was to turn their allies, Macedon, into a client kingdom. The force that did was stopped when their fleet was destroyed. Darius launched a second push in 490. This army would destroy Eretia and then turn on Athens. The Persian fleet deposited what modern scholars estimate 25,000 infantry and 1,000 cavalry in the Bay of Marathon in Attica onto a plain, while 9,000 Athenians and 1,000 Plataeans blocked their exit. After 5 days of stalemate, the Greeks, for reasons that no one really knows, advanced. The Greeks controlled the high ground and had Spartan reinforcements coming their way. The Persians had only hesitated because they didn't want to attack the Greek phalanx head-on. Anyway, we only know what happened, not why it happened, so let's just roll on. As you should remember from earlier, a phalanx could not be outflanked, or it would be destroyed. Therefore, the Greeks gambled by spreading their forces thinly across the plain, and they made the centre of the line thinner and added depth to the flanks. This meant that it would be easier to break through, but it protected their flanks, which was vitally important. Having seen the Greeks come off their hill, the Persians attacked. The Persians had success in the centre and were even able to break through the line, but the Greeks' deeper wings meant that the Persian wings were quickly routed. The Greek wings simply turned inward and crushed the centre. Herodotus reports that while the Persians lost 6,400 troops, the Athenians lost only 192, and the Plataeans only lost 11. This is a prime example of how the Persian army couldn't stand up to a strong phalanx, a fact that would haunt them again and again. The waves of Persian troops were useless against the disciplined armoured killing machine that was a phalanx. Now, I simply cannot pass this point without going off at a tangent to explain the origin of the marathon. According to legend, a Greek messenger, Philodippides, ran the entire distance from the battle site to Athens, about 26 miles, without stopping, and when he arrived, he exclaimed, "Nimaikeman." In English, "We have won." He then collapsed and died. Did this actually happen? Probably not. The story first appears in Plutarch's On the Glory of Athens in the 1st century AD, and the name is given as Thersippus, Urchius, or Eucles. In the 2nd century AD account of Lucian of Samosata, he gives the same story, but with the runner as Philippides. Herodotus mentions a runner called Pheidippides, who ran from Athens to Sparta to announce the arrival of the Persians, a 300-mile round trip. The runner is called Philippides in some accounts, and there is no mention of him running to Athens to give the result of the battle. Nice story, though. Following this disaster for the Persians was a 10-year interbellum period between wars. The Persians had to deal with a revolt in Egypt, and a new king, Xerxes I, came to power. Xerxes restarted the plans for a second Greek invasion. In Athens, the silver mine at Laurium produced a considerable surplus, and there was much debate over what to do with the newfound wealth. Some argued that it should be spread out among the population, 10 drachmas a man, but Themistocles argued that it should be spent to create a fleet. Indeed, his point of view was carried, and 200 ships were built. This was to prove a salvation for the Greeks. The number of Greek cities opposed to Persia was expanded to 21, forming an anti-Persian confederate alliance, including the two most powerful city-states, Athens and Sparta. As you will notice, 21 is a clear minority of 1,400, and they did fail to gain support from many city-states. Argos refused to help, as neither Athens nor Sparta would give up the command of the coalition. Gelon, the tyrant of Syracuse, refused to help also, although he would have a valid reason due to the huge invasion of Sicily by Carthage happening at that time. The force that was assembled would be tested in 480. 200,000 Persians would invade Greece. The Greeks initially planned to stop the Persians at the Vale of Temple in Thessaly, but after receiving news from King Alexander I of Macedon that the Persians would be able to get around the pass, they retreated. They settled on defending another pass, this one at Thermopylae, with reserve forces protecting the isthmus at Corinth. This would prevent the Persians from reaching southern Greece. The navy, meanwhile, would protect the coast, preventing the land forces from being outflanked. Only an advanced force was placed at Thermopylae under the command of the Spartan king Leonidas. Realising the mission was hopeless, Leonidas sent the majority of his forces south to Corinth, while he himself stayed at the pass with about 2,000 troops, including famously 300 Spartans. The Persians suffered heavy losses trying to break through the Greek line, but a local betrayed the Greek forces, and the Persians were able to sneak around the back. The Greeks were massacred. Hearing of this defeat, the Greek navy retreated to the island of Salamis, after fighting an indecisive battle at Artemisium. The land forces retreated to Corinth, and Athens was abandoned. Left with only a handful of defenders, Athens would be sacked by the Persians. This is an important piece of information, as you will see later. so remember it. After sacking Athens, Xerxes wanted to end the war quickly, and a fleet of what modern historians estimate at 700 ships was to be used to defeat the Greek navy of around 370 ships stationed at the island of Salamis, just off the southwestern coast of Attica. The Greek navy was able to draw the Persians into the narrow straits of Salamis, where the huge Persian numbers became more of a hindrance than a help, and the Greeks successfully captured or destroyed at least 200 ships, while losing only 40. And so, 480 BC drew to a close, at something of a stalemate. The Persians controlled most of Greece, but the Greeks quite safely controlled the Peloponnese. Unless, of course, you were an Athenian, in which case it was all bad, as you had lost your city. The Persians tried tempting the Athenians from the coalition, but they stayed loyal. The next year saw the Greeks advance north into Boeotia, near the city of Plataea, who you will remember fought at the Battle of Marathon with the Athenians. Eventually, the various Greek sections of the army became separated during a manoeuvre, and the Persian commander, Mardonius, who had been left in charge by Xerxes, who had returned to Persia, decided that this would be the best chance he would have to destroy the Greek force. Mardonius ordered his men to attack, but they were unable to win against the Greek phalanxes. The 70,000 to 120,000 Persians had been defeated by 40,000 Greeks. After hearing of this victory, the Greek navy decided to strike while the iron was hot, and attacked the Persians at the Battle of Mycale. The Greeks deployed on land, and once again the phalanx proved superior. The second invasion of Greece was over, but the war was not. Because this is becoming quite a long episode, we're going to stop the narrative here, and resume it next week with the story of classical Greece, and how Macedon rose from the small, irrelevant kingdom to the north of Greece to become the power that would dominate the known world. First, though, we shall end by taking a look at what sources we'll be using for this period. There are two main sources that I will be using for this podcast, Arrian and Plutarch, as well as several minor sources like the numerous documentaries I've seen across the years. Before I go too deep into Arrian and Plutarch, I'll just mention that there are two other sources that I will not be using in detail but may reference: Diodorus of Sicily and Curtius Rufus. Plutarch was born in AD 46 in Greece and died about AD 120. He had studied at the Academy in Athens, had been a priest of Apollo at Delphi, had held posts in his local government. He's also reported to have been the governor of the Roman province of Achaia, but this doesn't appear until the 10th century AD, so who knows how reliable it is. He's most famous, though, as a biographer. He released a series of parallel lives, in which he would compare a famous Roman and Greek. His biography on Alexander the Great is paired with Julius Caesar. Plutarch paired biographies to compare their morals, on which he judges character. He writes in a series of anecdotes of dubious reliability. He's writing to entertain, and he does a good job of this. Arrian, on the other hand, was born in about AD 86 in northwest Turkey, and died about AD 160. He is not writing to entertain. Arrian was a politician and general. He'd been consul, governor of Cappadocia, archon at Athens, and probably served in Gaul and along the Danube. He gives us lots of detail, but it can be a dry read. He's reliable with his facts, though, so I'm quite willing to overlook the dryness. One problem for us is that most sources we use on Alexander were written a few hundred years after his death, Plutarch and Arrian were writing about 450 to 500 years after the fact. This means that there are many inconsistencies. I'm going to do my best and try to give you the most likely version, but there are lots of contradictions between sources, sometimes within the sources. So be aware that with most of what I'm going to tell you, there are other versions of the story out there. It doesn't help that both Arrian and Plutarch are biased in favour of Alexander, and Plutarch is extremely biased against the Persian barbarians. So, there you are, an introduction. Next week, the narrative will march forward into classical Greece. I sincerely hope that you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, there are several things you can do. Firstly, as mentioned before, I have other podcasts you can download: A History of Hannibal and the Punic Wars, The Arab Spring, A History, and A History of Alexander. If you want to spoil this series, you can listen to the Alexander one, although the quality is a bit rough. You may just want to follow along with this highly improved version over the next 25 weeks or so. You can also visit us online, thehistoryofpodcast.blogspot.com, facebook.com/thehistoryofpodcast, twitter.com/thehistoryofpod, youtube.com/thehistoryofpodcast, or you can send me an email, thehistoryofpodcast@gmail.com. Music credit goes to Peter John Ross. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.